Okay, well, I wanted to start by thanking the organizers for inviting me. It's been quite an interesting week, and also make a small apology. This talk has nothing directly to do with Casimir effect, although the conformal field theory methods are also used to calculate Casimir forces in 2D critical systems. What I am going to talk about is correlations in mostly in 2D critical systems, which exhibit exact factorization, meaning that you can write a higher order, more complicated function, correlation function in terms of less complicated ones. And this is work that's done in collaboration with Jake Simmons, who was a previous student, now at Oxford, and Bob Ziff at University of Michigan, who does very nice computer simulations and has, well, he's the kind of guy who has your idea simulated before you realize how foolish it was. And I'd like to also acknowledge support from NSF for this work. So I'll be talking mostly about percolation, so I'll just describe that first for those of you who may not be so familiar with it, and then just mention some of the CFT toolbox that we're using here, and particularly the operators that come up. Operators being actually fields, really, that's a better way to think of them. And then define the crossing and connection probabilities and show their factorizations, and mention some of the extensions of this work. So, as I said, percolation is the main focus, and it's deceptively easy to define. Just imagine a large square lattice of points, and it doesn't have to be square, any regular lattice, or even for some cases irregular lattices will do. And you can put down, say, bonds between neighboring points with independent probability P. So between every two red points, you put down a green bond with probability P, or not with probability 1 minus P. And so a configuration on a small lattice might look something like that. Okay. Now, if the probability is small, then the large scale behavior of this, the thermodynamics, so to speak, I say thermodynamics in quotes because there's no energies here, but the large scale behavior at small p would just be isolated clusters, okay, almost all the time. For large p, you can get clusters, you will get clusters that cross the entire system. And the transition between those two things is actually a phase transition. You can, in fact, show in complete rigor that there exists a value of p called pc where there's a transition in this behavior. And that's the point that I'm interested in, because that's where conformal field theory applies at the phase transition at second order. And for the aficionados, that's central charge zero. So in particular, it's a non-unitary theory, because if it was unitary, it would be completely trivial. And now, of course, it's field theory, so we're looking in the continuum limit. But it turns out that in percolation, for various reasons which are, I think, not completely understood, that the continuum limit is a very good approximation. You can go down to quite small systems before you see any sizable corrections to it. But at any rate, what happens in CFT is you get differential equations for the various quantities, and you have to, you have to solve them, which in the cases we're looking at isn't particularly hard, but then you got to figure out what the solutions mean. That's where most of the work comes in. It turns out that they describe the crossing probabilities of the densities of a cluster. And a little more technically, we're going to be using CFT in the upper half plane. But since it's conformally invariant, you can map the upper half plane into any closed region you want. Now, the clusters I showed before, that's at a small lattice, but if you look at the percolation point, the clusters are very ramified. They're fractal. Here's just a single cluster. I mean, there would be other clusters near it, but here's just a picture of a simulation of a single cluster at PC, and you can see how, jagged looking it is. I forget who did this. I think it was Bob Ziff, but I'm not sure. But at any rate, that's what they look like. Probably. I mean, as far as you can tell, this is, of course, on a finite lattice because it's a simulation. So, but presumably it would, were you to continue the lattice, it would probably continue. I'm not sure what bounding conditions were used here. They may be open. They're probably open, actually, because it doesn't. Yeah, it looks like it. Yeah, I think these are open boundaries, not periodic. And that's important, actually. We're going to be looking at things not on periodic systems. Okay. These are systems with boundaries, real boundaries. Okay, so a little bit of the conformal toolbox. There are three operators I'm going to be, well, I'll mention another one later, but for the most part, three operators that I'm using. First of all, phi 1-2, no, the 1-2 is the Katz index. It's a way of bookkeeping these operators. And what that does is implement a change from fixed to free boundaries at a point x on the boundary, so on the boundary of the upper half plane. So on the left, say the bonds can be there or not, but on the right, all the bonds on the boundary would be occupied. So, okay. So that's fixed. And then phi 1-3, that, it turns out, creates a cluster which is anchored to the boundary at the point x. Okay. So whatever else is going on, there's got to be a cluster at point x, and then the rest of the boundary is free. And then up in the bulk, off the boundary, is phi 3/2, 3/2. That's sometimes called the magnetization operator because it's the analog of the order parameter operator, like the spin operator in the Ising model. But what it does for us here is measure the density of clusters at a point z, that is, if you like, at a very small, in a small disk around the point z.
5-1-3, but what do you mean by cluster? It's again the infinite cluster?
No, it doesn't have to be infinite. I think any cluster that is anchored there. But when you put in more than one of them, then they have to be connected together. And so the cluster has to be big enough to get from one point to another. Okay, that's really what counts here. And these operators have conformal dimensions, which are from which you get very simply scaling dimensions. The 1-2 has dimension 0, 1-3 has dimension 1/3, and the order parameter 1 has dimension 596. Okay, that again comes from this Katz classification. And that's one of the ways, by matching up by knowing the dimension of the operator, that's one of the ways you can tell what it's doing. Okay. I mean, conformal field theory is kind of a very, very fancy bookkeeping, but it exists in isolation from any physical model. So once you've worked out something in a conformal field theory, you've got to figure out what does it mean in terms of the physical model. And that's often, as I mentioned, a lot of the tasks that it sets you. So just to give a simple example, consider the density of clusters at z which hit the boundary somewhere. Okay. So you can think of that in terms of a picture. So what's the probability of the point z having a cluster that goes through z and hits the boundary somewhere? Of course, the cluster won't look like that. It'll have a lot more to it, but there has to be a path from it to the boundary. That's just a two-point correlation function of two density operators. Okay, why two points? Well, you have the density operator at z. But because you're in the upper half plane, you have to have an image operator at z bar. Okay. That was first pointed out by Cardi. And so you end up with a two-point function. And that's just a simple power law, right? It's just the distance between them, which is just y, the vertical distance in the half plane, to the power of twice the conformal dimension. So now it's 548 instead of 596. Right. And I'll use this notation. Script P for the probability of finding a cluster that connects its arguments.
Now, where does it say that it's connected to the boundary?
That's just the way it works out.
So, 3/2 was just the density at some points.
Right. Yeah, it has to go down there. It's because, well, I guess what's really enforcing that is the boundary condition, I think, that it's free. Okay.
Well, the image part, right?
I don't think so, though, not really. Yeah. Right.
So the phi operator is the amplitudes for these probabilities, then if there's two of them multiplied together rather than the probabilities themselves?
Well, they're really the fields, and you have to average them, right? That's what the brackets are. You've got to average this over the ensemble, or just over the set of configurations. It's not even really an ensemble because there's no energy in percolation. But so they're the fields. That's the distance, the vertical. Sorry, it's just the vertical distance, just the usual x. Yeah, z is x plus r y. Yeah, just in the usual way. Sorry, I should have probably drawn that in there, but I didn't. All right. If you look at two points on the boundary, the probability of connecting those is given by two phi 1-3 operators sitting at the two points x1 and x2. So again, that's a power law because it's just two operators in there. And it, but now the power is 2/3 because each phi has a dimension 1/3. This is actually a limit of Cardy's formula, which gives you the crossing probability of going from one side of a rectangle to another, say, probably finding a cluster that goes from, say, the left side of a rectangle to the right side. And in the limit when it's long and thin, it's conformally equivalent to this of having two points just by mapping. And finally, the last one, which is easy to work out, is the probability of a cluster that connects some point on the boundary. So you got to put a phi 1/3 here at this point x1 to the point z up in the bulk. Okay. Now that involves three operators because you have to put the image operator in again. Okay, so that's a little bit more complicated. In general, a three-point correlation function is not going to be known, but in conformal, because of conformal invariance, it's easy to show. And this was actually the original work in conformal invariance in this area by Polyakov years ago. It's easy to show that it has a very simple form. It's just the product of powers of the distances, the three distances between the three points. Okay? And in this particular case, it just works out like that. So here's the distance between, y is the distance between z and z bar, and then you have a distance between x1 and z and x1 and z bar that combine together to give you that. And there's a little rule for the powers that works out this way. And again, I mean, you can test this. I mean, the previous one has been tested by computer simulations too, but you can test this with computer simulations, and it agrees extremely well. What it's giving you is the way in which this probability depends on the positions of the points, right? There's also a constant in front of here, which is not determined by CFT, because it's not universal. It depends on the particular realization of percolation, whether you do, say, bond percolation on a square lattice or in a triangular lattice. Okay. And that can't, CFT can't make that distinction. All right, but now we get to the more interesting one, the probability of finding a cluster that connects x1, x2, and the point z. Okay. Now you need four operators, right? Because you have the two points on the boundary, the point z and its image. So this is a little more complicated because by conformal invariance, you can show that any such correlation function has the form of a product of powers, of distances, times some function of the cross ratio of the four points. Okay. So that's as far as you can go in general, okay, if you didn't know what the operators were. And here, the cross ratio, you can choose it in various ways, but I've just chosen them like that. Yeah, that's just the hopefully familiar cross ratio from complex variables. And also, there are various ways to write this. They're all equivalent. But it has to take on that form. Okay. And so you're left with the problem of trying to determine this function f of eta. Okay. But because I have the phi 1/3 operators, or actually one would be enough, in that correlation function, the correlation satisfies the third order differential equation. Okay. And that comes out of, that's really using the conformal invariance of this problem, because that's a whole long story as to how you get to the point of showing that it satisfies a differential equation at all. But at any rate, it does. That's well known. And of course, since it's a third order differential equation, you're going to have three linearly independent solutions. But if you look at the asymptotic behavior as x1 goes to x2, you can figure out which solution corresponds to the diagram that I want. Okay. So that's the identification problem. And in doing that, it's useful to introduce a variable, which is that angle zeta up there in the upper left. So that's the interesting angle. Just draw the triangle between the three points. And it turns out that one solution of this third order differential equation is just sine zeta to the 1/3. Okay. And you can sort of, well, you can almost see where that's coming from. When you bring x1 and x2 together, I didn't say it, but that's two phi 1/3 operators. And you get from that a unit operator and a phi 1/3 operator and a phi 1/5 operator. But what you want is, when these two points come together, just to have a single line connecting. So you want something to the power 1/3, and that's exactly what this 1/3 is here. Yeah. And
You went too fast. Why power 1/3?
Well, because what you want to do is have a cluster which goes from z to one point on the boundary. And that means you're putting a phi 1/3 here. And that's where it comes from. You know, that's a little quick, but that's basically the idea. And so the complete solution then looks like this. And what's nice about that is that it's algebraic. That's where this factorization that I'm about to show comes from. The other two solutions actually, in this case, involve hypergeometric functions. You can interpret them physically also, but they're not algebraic. And since it's algebraic, I mean, you can put together now, so we've got solutions for all four quantities here, and they combine in that form. So the probability of connecting two points on the boundary to a point in the interior is equal to the square root of the product of connecting any two points, well, there are three ways of doing that, times a constant. Okay? That's then an exact equation. The constant that appears there, we can figure out exactly, I'll say how in a minute, but it has that nice form involving a gamma to the 1/3 to the power 9/2 and so forth, various constants. And numerically, it's a little bit bigger than 1. It's not 1, it's 1 point, but it's 1.0299. Okay. So here's the equation, maybe in an easier way to think about it. Just, you can write it just sort of diagrammatically. Okay. Now, as I've kind of mentioned, but I'll say it again, this is universal. It applies to any realization of percolation as long as it's, I mean, not, there are certain types of percolation which are not conformally invariant, like directed percolation, but any percolation that is conformally invariant, which is a lot of different ways of realizing it, and it's also exact. Okay, so this is not an approximation. And now, if you let the point z go to the boundary, you can argue using again pretty standard conformal arguments that C1 is a boundary operator product expansion coefficient. And that's the first step in figuring out exactly what it's equal to. But maybe a little more interesting is that this factorization holds in any simply connected region. What will happen is the form of these functions will change, but this relation will not. And the C1 stays the same, too. So I think that the factorization itself is more interesting than knowing the actual solution. It's the fact that they factorize in this particular way that makes this interesting. Because this is, for many years, people in fluids have tried various ways to understand higher order correlations in terms of something else, like, for instance, lower order correlations. But I don't know there's any other exact result like that.
So this is supposed to hold on for percolation?
No, it's more general. More general. Sorry?
Any conformal
theory? Yeah, I'll get to that. I mean, the only thing that changes is the C1. Well, we don't know how to interpret it in physically in any case, but it certainly holds for the POTS models. That we've already checked, and I'll get to that. Yeah?
If X1 becomes the same as X2, right, then probability in the left will have to be equal to the second probability and the square root and the third probability and the square root.
Right, but there's also...
Is it correct?
Yeah, but it also diverges. I mean, this one will diverge, right? Because that one goes like one over the
so
distance to the two-thirds.
Compensation of the divergence.
Yeah, the left side will diverge too.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that all drops out. I mean, and you can see it's homogeneous, right? You have the same number of x1 points on the left as on the right, if you consider the square root. So you don't have to worry about, I mean, as I mentioned, you know, I didn't put in any of the constants that are non-universal here that connect you to an explicit model, but you don't need it for this because they drop out. It'd be the same left and right. So that has to be true for the actual physical quantities, not just the conformal solutions. Okay, so how do I get C1? Well, I showed you what it was before, but that comes, just roughly speaking, from the transformation properties of the hypergeometric functions that arise here. Okay, so of course, we tested this with computer simulation to make sure we weren't making some kind of mistake. And actually, we found the C1 value Bob Ziff found before we figured out what it ought to be conformally. What he got was 1.030. To three significant digits, and remember, the conformal prediction was 1.0299, so it agrees, you know, as well as it could. And here's just some pictures. So here he's plotting the density of a cluster. In the top line, they're clusters that are anchored on the left. This isn't a square, not in an upper half plane. And the periodicity in the colors doesn't mean anything. The density is dropping off as you move away, as it should, just the way he colored it. And then on the bottom, one of those is the density of clusters that are anchored to two points on the boundary, so that's the px1, x2, z. And the other one is the right-hand side of the equation, but I can't remember which is which, and it doesn't really matter much because you can barely tell them apart because you're good to one part in a thousand. Okay, but all of this leaves an unanswered question. I don't really have any heuristic argument for this. I mean, this factorization comes out of the mathematics, but we haven't found any good reason for why it should. Okay. And that's certainly something that's been in my mind for a while. So now actually you can do a bit more than this. For instance, if instead of putting phi 1, 3 operators at the points x1 and x2, I put phi 1, 2 operators, and if you remember, those are the operators which change the boundary condition from fixed to free, okay? Then you can derive from that, now you'll have actually, since they're phi 1, 2 operators, they satisfy a second order differential equation, so there are two solutions. It's a little bit easier in that sense. But if you take the right set of solutions, you can show that one of them represents the probability of the point z being connected to the interval between x1 and x2. Yeah, because here you have fixed boundaries there, so this is always in the cluster. Okay. And that one is sine to the 1/3 of zeta over 2, has a sine to the 1/3 of zeta over 2 in it. I mean, again, when you bring these two points together, you should get a zeta to the 1/3, so that's why it's that one. And the other one is connecting to the alternate interval, and there when you bring the two points together, you should just get the 1 over y to the 5/48 like before, and that's how you identify it. But again, these are algebraic. Okay. So you can re-express them, and one way, there's various ways to do it, but one way is now to express, so here are the two interval probabilities. Well, look at the picture, that's easier. The two interval probabilities can then be expressed in terms of the one we were looking at before with the square root factorization and then some of the two-point functions. Okay. So again, that's exact. But this is a little bit different than what you usually look at in fluids, because these probabilities here with the intervals are not probabilities of connecting points, they're probabilities of connecting a point with an interval. Okay, so that's a different kind of quantity than one usually looks at. Also, this equation is a little more complicated in the sense that now the C2 that comes up is actually a ratio of operator product expansion coefficients. You can still calculate it, but it's in that sense a little more complicated. And of course, you can do this in various ways. You could write the p x1, x2, z in terms of two-point functions, so you could get rid of that if you wanted to. I won't burden you with all the possible expressions. All right, so let's go back to the original factorization. That's the one we've paid most attention to so far. If you look at this in simulation, you could ask the question, what happens if you move one of the points x1 or x2 off the boundary, right? Does it still hold? Well, it doesn't hold everywhere, but it does hold asymptotically. And that indicates that other solutions are coming in, other conformal blocks are coming in, but they have higher dimensions, so the thing still dies off to a constant when you get far enough away. And furthermore, you can look at this, and I'll say a little more in a minute, but both numerically and theoretically, for other problems, in particular for connection probabilities involving Fortuyn-Castellan clusters in the Q-state POTS models. So you can do it in the Ising model, the three-state POTS model, and so on. And numerically, it works quite well. Here's some numerical evidence. So this is for the Ising model. And this is looking at the ratio. So in other words, you simulate what's under the square root, and you simulate the left-hand side and divide them. I simulate the whole square root, I should say, and divide it into the simulation of the left-hand side, and you'll get some number which will not be quite constant, right, because it has various corrections.
For POTS model, is there a direct relation to correlation functions of spins?
Sure, yeah. It's the same, pretty much the same interpretation. Yeah, it's pretty much the same interpretation, I think it's not. And so these two points here are the anchor points, and there this should break down, there's finite size corrections. But as I mentioned, they're not very large. They only extend for a few lattice spacings around the anchor point. And elsewhere, this ratio is pretty much constant. Of course, there's some noise. but you can see that it's pretty much constant, and it's a little bit larger. It's more like 1.075 instead of 1.03. So it changes as it should, and we can predict that now from a conformal quantity. And here it is. That was averaging over the first few rows. This is averaging over the whole square, 128 by 128. And by the way, you can get an idea here. You don't have to go to particularly large systems to get pretty good results. And this is 128 by 128. You don't have to do 10,000 by 10,000 or something like that. So the corrections to this formula due to finite size effects and due to any possible correction to scaling terms is quite small, even in, I think it's even smaller in percolation than here. This is the Ising model. Okay, another thing we've done is look at this at the 3D percolation point. So this is moving away from 2D entirely. And there, numerically, the ratio is constant to within about 3%. Okay. Now, exactly why there's, so the error is a bit larger than it is for 2D percolation. Exactly why that is, we're not sure yet. We're still working on that. And of course, in this case, you don't have conformal field theory. You have conformal invariance in 3D, but that's nowhere near as strong as conformal field theory. So there's no way to calculate that function f of eta way back at the beginning, you know, for the 2 points on the boundary being connected. That was involved in the probability of 2 points on the boundary being connected to 1 point in the interior. And the best you can do is see whether the expressions or the numerics are consistent with such a function that only depends on the cross ratio. You'd still have a function depending on the cross ratio, but there's no way to figure out what it is other than get some asymptotic values. So,
no theoretical one. Let's say if I take the Ising model in 3 dimensions,
right,
corresponding.
I don't know, we haven't tried that. In
2 dimensions, there is.
There's certainly a corresponding question, yeah, but whether it factorizes, I don't know yet. I mean, we haven't looked at that.
Presumably, say, by epsilon expansion around 4 dimensions for Ising model, one can answer yes or no.
I guess you could see whether it worked in epsilon expansion. Yeah, we haven't tried anything like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could see what happens, right? Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, now back to 2D again. Okay, but now I want to go away from, actually, this is really, in a sense, away from models. If you take two operators, so I'm using now 1/2 0 instead of 3/2 3/2, but they're equivalent for percolation on actually any of the unitary minimal models like the POTS model. Just a slightly different notation in a sense. But at any rate, if you look at the correlation function, and here I've written it slightly differently because I was having horrible computer problems last night, but anyway. Instead of z bar, I put in z star, and instead of two operators, I got one with two arguments, but it means the same thing. So if you look at now the correlation function, this is just like the original correlation function, 2 phi 1 3s and another operator here of 5 1/2 0. You can show that for any central charge, whatever, there's always a solution of this which satisfies that original factorization.
So just remind us, what we had to date was for C equals north, was it?
Except for the Ising case, yeah, right. Right. But no, this is for arbitrary C.
So now you move C up to arbitrary.
Right, right. And furthermore, certainly these are the only operators that have fixed cat's indices for any C that satisfy this. And it looks like they're the only operators, period. Although we haven't quite finished that proof. That factorization is there. What it means, I don't know yet. We aren't really worried about physical interpretations of it. Because, you know, for arbitrary central charge, you can have a whole zoo of models so that correspond to it. We haven't really worried about that at this point. So there's something, you know, it seems that there's something fairly general going on here. And finally, let's go back to where we started, which is 2D percolation. Now I'm going to have to draw a diagram because I ran out of steam last night, but maybe that's better anyway. I want to look at a rectangle with fixed boundary conditions. So I'm going to look at percolation, and I'm going to fix the boundary conditions on the left and the right of the rectangle. So that means whatever clusters are present, there's always a cluster that includes this edge and a cluster that includes that edge. Okay. And then I'll pick some point z in the middle, right? And if that connects to the left edge, then we'll call that the probability of connecting from z to left. And if you have a cluster that goes through z and also hits the left and the right, that's PLR of z. Okay. But now, so far, these boundary conditions don't matter. But what's different here is if you have a cluster that connects the left and the right, and another one over here that connects up to z, okay, that will contribute to PLZ, and it also will contribute to PLR of z, okay, because you can go here to the left and down and then across to the right. Okay. Now, if you do that, if you put on those boundary conditions, and this is where Bob Ziff was way ahead of us. He did this by simulation first, and then simulate this ratio where pi h is the crossing probability. That's the probability of finding any cluster that goes from left to right, no matter what point it goes through. That's known from Cardy's formula. So if you simulate this and calculate that ratio, it turns out that c of z, so this is the thing that would have been constant, okay, in the if these were points, if you specified points on the ends rather than intervals. But it turns out that ratio numerically is constant to within a few percent everywhere in the rectangle. It's just near the ends that it deviates a little bit. Okay. And it's only a function of x. It does not depend on y. So it only depends on, So it's just the usual xy coordinates. Y is going up and x is going to the right. Why that is, I don't know, but it's true. And so having noticed this, we started calculating, and it turns out that you can actually calculate these quantities exactly in the semi-infinite strip, so that's like a very long rectangle. Okay. And there, when you're far from either ends, this problem reduces to the original problem, because when you're far away from the ends, they look like points. And so you have the probability of connecting a point z to two points on the boundary. Okay. It's exactly like the original problem. But when you're not far from the ends in the semi-infinite strip, so when one end is far away but you're near the other one, you can exactly calculate that ratio. In fact, you can calculate all the quantities. And it turns out to have a really pretty form in terms of two hypergeometric functions like that. And that C0 is the same constant we had before, the 10299. So we can do that. And in addition, we can get expressions for all the quantities on C of x in an arbitrary rectangle, but there we have to assume the y independence because we need to put one operator on the boundary in order to calculate. It gets this horrendous if you don't. And I'll spare you the expressions. They're kind of long, so I don't think they would help very much, but if someone wants to see them, I'll be glad to show. So that's pretty much the story. So we have some results from conformal field theory that show exact and universal factorizations of higher order correlation functions in terms of lower order ones in critical 2D percolation. And you can generalize the results to other 2D systems and also to 3D percolation. And there's a couple of, well, those references are slightly out of date, but anyway, there's some of the references for it. Okay, thanks for your attention. Yeah, there's a, what is that? It should do, yeah. But the conformal model,
Irrespective of the shape of the boundary.
Right, yeah, any, you can map it into any closed shape. As long as it doesn't have a hole in it, you're fine. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I haven't thought about that at all.
So there's someone coming from completely outside the field. Yeah. You have to excuse me.
Please.
For a dumb question, but to someone coming from having thought about correlation functions in particular systems and noting that there are things like the random phase approximation, where effectively you approximated a dynamic two-point function by a product of one-point functions. Mm-hmm. So that's a kind of mean field theory. And there are higher ones too in field theory. this sort of has the same sniff to it. I mean, obviously it isn't field theory in the usual sense, but you've got a three-point function degenerating into products of two-point functions, for example. That's not quite a straight product where there's a spirit. Is there some sense in which this relates somehow to the used degenerate?
That's a, well,
the regular correlation functions in outside of necessarily percolation theory.
Well, as I'm mentioning, I mean, it certainly applies to other 2D systems, but whether you can relate it to these other kinds of methods or approximations, I don't actually know. I mean, probably not, because, I mean, you do have that constant which is non-trivial in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But and it's extremely close to one in the first.
Well, yeah, in that example.
It wasn't exactly.
No, it's not exactly one, and I think that's significant.
The square root of the square root, there's no analog of that.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah. So my guess is not, but I have no argument. I mean, that's just.
Just
yeah,
it's
I know.
The
yeah.
Final result that you have will work.
I mean, if I had a heuristic for this, I could probably answer you better, but I don't, so, to be honest.
I just thought we can use some fancy relative to the Hoffman-Higgs theorem. Probability distribution is Gaussian.
Except that it works in, I mean, even the Ising is, you know, free fermion, so. Although maybe these are, well. Yeah, it works anyway. Yeah.
But it only works when two points are at the back.
Right. It's not as strong as Wick, right? And that's okay. Right.
But Kenny doesn't have any idea if it works if you have more points on the bottom?
No, it gets harder and harder. See, the trouble is every time you add a point, you get another cross ratio. So instead of having a function of one cross ratio, you have a function of two or three or four, and that gets really hairy really fast. But we were able to do that, you know, the semi-infinite case, that's actually, it's a 1, 2, 3, it's a five-point function. So there's two cross ratios, but there was enough symmetry in it that we were able to solve it exactly. After a lot of, it took a bit of an effort, but that didn't work. But as you add more, it just gets worse and worse. I think there might have been some example like that in Jake's thesis, but it wasn't so physical, you know, where he was able to see how to handle more and more points, but not in the cases that look like they would be particularly interesting. So.
So do you have a quick hand wave of how these, because you can apply this to the fluctuations in one system and to the fluctuations in another, and then use some kind of theory of coupled fluctuations to get Van der Waals-like results?
That was the reason for my disclaimer. I doubt this has anything directly to do with Casimir forces.
So you're not able to.
Yeah, I mean, that's a different.
Most theories of these forces involve coupling of fluctuations between systems. So.
Right. I mean, the simple calculation of Casimir force in 2D conformal field theory involves transforming, I mean, the stress tensor from, say, the upper half plane to some region, and that involves the Schwarz derivative of the transformation, which you then have to integrate against the, you know, the stretching function, and that gives you the Casimir force. So it's a rather different calculation.
I think you have to use this kind of theory always to derive the Casimir part of all.
Fluctuations
of a single system,
right.
And translate that to two systems, it may not be so hard.
Okay.
You don't have to use these fancy type theories to do it.
I like the fancy theories.
Well, it's an easy answer.